Welcome to the Veritas Podcast. For even more exciting content, visit our website at www.veritaswbc.com. Enjoy the podcast.
I'm going to continue our series on disturbing divine behavior. And, you know, when I began the talk last week, we were looking into some concerns largely based on the new atheists, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, and Daniel Dennett. I gave some quotes from them that, you know, one of the things that they were saying is, you know, we're not encouraging you to not read the Bible. And these are even as atheists. They were saying, we're encouraging you to read the Bible. And once you read the Bible, it will give you good reasons to reject belief in God, or certainly at least to not say that God is worthy of worship. Because the kind of God that would demean women or, you know, encourage genocide just isn't a God that's worthy of that kind of affection from us. And so that's where we're why we're doing the series that we're doing. I'll admit on the front end, I totally stole the title, by the way. You know, sometimes it's, you know, you look for these creative titles. And when I was researching some years ago on a book that I was working with Paul Copan and Heath Thomas on, called Holy War in the Bible, one of the people that I read was Eric Siebert. And Eric Siebert wrote a book called Disturbing Divine Behavior. And I was like, yeah, he has a cooler title than me, so I'm just going to steal it. So I'm just going to give Eric some credit. The funny thing about it is that Eric and I, we disagree on like everything. So how about that? So I kept his title and I disagree with his ideas. So there you have it. We'd like to welcome all the babies that are here too as well. And just so you know, that gave my wife an opportunity to hold a baby. Because we have four, but that wasn't quite enough. And so, it really wasn't, at least not for her. So tonight we're going to get into the question of the Canaanites. And largely because as you look into the Old Testament, what people largely struggle with is this command in Joshua chapter 11, verse 20, where it seems that what is being said is that God hardens the heart of the Canaanites, and after hardening the hearts of the Canaanites, he uses them basically as vessels of wrath, and the idea is to wipe them out. But before we get into that, and I'll unpack that here in a little bit, and you may need to scribble some notes down because I'm going to unpack quite a bit for you tonight. I want to ask the question and just begin in a different place. And the question is simply this: who were the Canaanites? You know, if the Old Testament is going to be referring to these people, and if there is this command to wipe them out, I just want to know who they are. You know, a lot of times when you look in the United States and we have enemy combatants, we know who they are. We know what's going on. You read the Old Testament, and everything that's happening there is coming from somewhere. There's history that's involved. So who were the Canaanites? Clay Jones has written pretty extensively on this topic because it's so troubling for people. And one of the things, there are a number of things that he highlights to say, when you look at the Canaanites, there's no one problem that they had. It's that they were a conglomeration of a lot of problems. So I just want to unpack a few of those for you this evening, and then we'll jump into the text. And then after that, we'll get into your questions. Sound good? So have your phone ready. You can all be on menti.com. And as I'm talking, I want you to feel free to write the questions in. Also, since Matthew's going to be up here with me, I want you to feel free to ask him a question. How many of you think Matthew ought to be answering questions too? Don't you agree with me? Yeah, there you go. No pressure, Matthew. All right. Welcome to the party. Okay, so what were some of the things that the Canaanites were up to? And here's the first, and I don't have these on slides or anything for you, but write these down. One is that they were known for idolatry. They were known for idolatry. The Canaanites worshipped other gods, which the Old Testament frequently denounced as no more than sticks or pottery made by human hands that cannot, and I quote, see or hear or smell or eat. That's in Deuteronomy chapter 4. Yahweh derided these handmade gods that cannot speak and must be carried because they can't even walk. You see that in Jeremiah chapter 1. It's like, why are you worshiping these gods? They can't even walk, right? But you're going to give them your whole self. But the Canaanites took seriously the testimony of the Old Testament witness of Yahweh and his revelation, if for no other reason than intentionally to transform the scriptural depiction of God into, and I'm just quoting here, into a castrated weakling who likes to play with his own poop and urine. That comes from them talking about Yahweh. Now, of course, Richard Dawkins, he likes to complain. And he says, and I just quote, God's monumental rage whenever his chosen people flirted with a rival God resembles nothing so much as sexual jealousy of the worst kind. I think he's missing the mark, but he says it. But does anyone think that if Dawkins' wife left him for a gingerbread man of her own baking, by the way, and this comes from Clay Jones, does anyone think that if Dawkins' wife left him for a gingerbread man of her own baking, and then she began to tell everyone that he liked to play with his excrement, that Dawkins would tolerate the characterization of his feelings as no more than sexual jealousy of the worst kind? Clay Jones goes on to say, I'm going to guess Dawkins would have a problem. Idolatry. When you think of idolatry, sometimes we don't appreciate the seriousness of idolatry, because idolatry bends our ability to love what God loves. That's the problem of idolatry. It bends our ability to love what God loves. And as a result, we love what God hates. And we hate what God loves. And the story of the Canaanites includes incest, adultery, child sacrifice, and bestiality. And it flows from that line of idolatry that was part and parcel of the way that they just did life on a daily basis. So the tragedy of the story, as Clay Jones says, is not only idolatry an offense to God, but it fails to supply a happy ending for human communities as well. That's the tragedy. So let's look at a couple of these things. Incest. Let's just say we're against it on the front end. But like all ancient Near East pantheons, so these cultures that had a belief in a lot of gods, the Canaanite pantheon was incestuous. Baal, you've probably, if you've read the Old Testament, you've seen this character Baal. Baal has sex with his mother Asherah, his sister Anat, and his daughter Pidre, and none of this is presented pejoratively. Now here's the thing, although early Canaanite laws proscribed either death or banishment for most forms of incest, after the 14th century BC, the penalties were reduced to basically a fine. So you keep that in mind. How common of a practice was this for early Canaanite practices and beliefs? And the answer is, it was actually rather common. And the thing was, it's not like it starts from the ground up, you know, from the people up. It starts from the top down. It's what their gods were doing, and then it filters down to their people. And on that level, it makes it even worse. Adultery. Canaanite religion, like other religions in the ancient Near East, it was a fertility religion that involved temple sex. Now, by the way, we're gonna be pretty blunt about some things tonight. So anytime you're reading the Old Testament or things that spill over into the New Testament, sometimes what you're running into are relics of Canaanite sex rituals, where in fact they would build monuments to their gods and they would have orgies on those monuments. I've been over into the area in the Middle East where I've got a group going with me in the not too distant future in September, and you can still see some of these stone monuments that are there. You can go stand on them. And this is the place where some of these, well, if you want to call them parties, these parties were happening. But a fertility religion, Ishtar, was known as the Queen of Heaven, and to quote one scholar, became the woman among the gods, patron of eroticism and sensuality, of conjugal love as well as adultery, of brides and prostitutes, transvestites, and pederasts. Now you may say, well, what's a pederast? It's the idea of a man having sex with a boy is what pederasty is. There's one professor at the University of Helsinki, Marty Nissinen, said sexual contact with a person whose whole life was devoted to the goddess was tantamount to union with the goddess herself. Here's the idea. The whole thing that's going on in these orgies is it was a way of connecting to God. So the Canaanites even remake the god of the Bible, El, after their own image and portray him ceremonially as having sex with women. So they take God and they impose that image onto God. The ceremony ends with these directions, and I quote, to be repeated 5 times by the company and the singers of the assembly. And then it goes on to say, we may well suppose that this activity of El was sacramentally experienced by the community in the sexual orgies of the fertility cult, which the Hebrew prophets so vehemently denounced. In other words, you cannot be practicing what the Canaanites were practicing, and even potentially try to bring this together with what God would have ever wanted. So there's the second thing. Third, we know that they were practitioners of child sacrifice. And this isn't to say it's describing something that the culture did that God was against. This is to say that this was something that they accepted and was accepted by their God. For example, Molech. Some of you reading the Old Testament would know that, would have heard of this character's name. But Molech was a Canaanite underworld deity, represented as an upright bull-headed idol with a human body in whose belly a fire was stoked, and whose outstretched arms a child was placed that would be burned to death. The victims were usually infants. Children as old as 4 were sacrificed. And so what we know is, and I'm just going to keep that point short, we know that that was a common practice also of the Canaanites. The only other one that I want to mention, and I'm just trying to say, who are the Canaanites? This is who they were. I hope this helps inform and shape who we're talking about. How about bestiality? Part of the problem, I was just in a discussion on Tuesday night down in Houston at Theology on Tap. There were a lot of questions about God and your relationships. It was God and your romantic life, God and your marriage, God and sex, and those kinds of things. A really broad audience was there. One of the themes that kept coming up is that every legitimate form of sexual practice, consent has to be required, right? If there's a lack of consent, then obviously you're dealing with the problem of rape. Now, we talked about a lot more than that, but that came up. But when it comes to bestiality, we're talking about people that, for religious reasons, are having sex with animals. And as you can imagine, it's difficult to decipher how it is that an animal could provide consent. We could just start there. But as some would say, this is probably the ultimate sexual depravity, is intercourse with animals. Nevertheless, Hittite laws, and I borrow from Clay Jones again, 199 says this: if anyone has intercourse with a pig or a dog, he shall die. If a man has intercourse with a horse or a mule, there is no punishment. Hello. And as with incest, the penalty for having sex with animals decreased as time went on. And there should be no surprise that bestiality would occur among the Canaanites, because guess what? Their gods practiced it. And so this is the catch. Again, it's not saying, hey, the people were doing this, but God was against it. It's that the gods were practicing it, and the people inherited the practices from God, or their God. And this explains why in certain cities, God sentenced to death everything that breathes. Have you seen that? So if they had sex with just about every living thing they could get their hands on, and they did, then ultimately these things were going to die. Richard Dawkins, I've quoted him before, but he objects that this just adds injury to insult, right? But what he doesn't seem to understand is that no one would want to have animals around who were used for having sex with humans. Nobody wanted them. I mean, even the animals became outcasts because of what they were doing. And this also might explain why God used a flood to destroy what Dawkins called the presumably blameless animals in the days of Noah. Everything had gotten to a place where it was so defiled that God says, okay, and now I'm going to intervene with judgment. I want to make a note, though, because I have a lot to say here in a little bit about other things about the Canaanites, but I want to say something about children as well. Because as you can imagine, being a child growing up in this culture couldn't have been easy. Can you imagine that? This is what every day looks like. This is normal. Life was hard on a Canaanite child because, among other things, the Canaanites committed 2 sins that damaged their own children. If you think about it, archaeological evidence shows that the Canaanites were an incestuous people. I've already talked about that. Sexual molestation, by the way, it's a crime in our society. It should be. But in Canaanite society, their god Baal rapes his sister while she was in the form of a calf 77, even 88 times. In other words, Baal rapes her a lot. Baal also regularly had sex with his daughter, Pidray. So it was just what their gods do. And we should expect that if the Canaanites worshiped a god who rapes his sister and has ongoing sexual relationships with his daughter, sexually humiliates his mother, that the Canaanites would actually practice the same behaviors themselves. This is why Psalm 115:8 says this: those who make idols become like them. Those who make idols become like them. So do all who trust in them. And this is the thing. Incest destroys the normal boundaries of a family. Destroys it. And so when you think about the children, which we should, And you say, well, what does a normal practice look like for the Canaanites? And I'm just giving you a picture of it tonight. Much, much more could be said. Then you think, what are the long-term effects that this would have on the overall emotional health, physical well-being of a child? And the idea is that it results in extremely high incidence, not just of damage to the kid, but of even birth defects because of what we know about incest and what happens when there's reproduction connected to incest. These are the people that are walking around. But there was a worse evil than molestation and rape, and that was offering a child Molech, which they did. Molech was a Canaanite underworld deity, as I mentioned before. But Plutarch is considered to be one of the best historians of the ancient Near East. And he reports that during the Phoenician sacrifices, and I'm just quote him, the whole area before the statue was filled with a loud noise of flutes and drums so that the cries of the wailing should not reach the ears of the people. So you have these practices that are going on, and they would make loud music so that you couldn't hear the people screaming as a result of what they were doing to them. And it wasn't just infants that they were doing this to. We know that children, at least as old, as I mentioned before, children at least as old as four were having the same things done to them. I just wanted to start there. I thought I'd start on a positive note. Now, I'm starting there for an obvious reason. Because if you're going to go into the Old Testament and you see God commanding something like, I want you to go in and wipe them out. Well, who's the they? Who are they that's being wiped out? I think it's good to know. Hopefully that's a good starting point. So now I just want to jump into the problem of violence in the Old Testament. Are you ready for it? Here we go. According to the Pentateuch, and for those of you that don't know, that's the first five books of the Old Testament. When God called forth his people out of slavery in Egypt and back to the land of their forefathers, he directed them to kill all the Canaanite clans who were living in the land. And I have this up here in your notes for those of you. Even if you get your phone out and take a picture of the slide, there you go. You see this in Deuteronomy chapter 7. You see it in Deuteronomy chapter 20 as well. Now, the way that the story reads is this. The destruction was to be absolute. It was to be complete. Every man, woman, and child was to be killed. If you look, for example, at the book of Joshua, it tells the story of Israel's carrying out God's command in city after city throughout Canaan. And this is the thing. When you think of Canaanites, you need to be thinking of different people groups, right? And over an expanse of land. It's not like they're right there. They're kind of cast out. So that's what's going on. Now, on the one hand, and Michael Austin has written on this, he said, if you think they deserve to die because of their wickedness, then you're going to be compared to the Taliban, right? So now nobody wants to say anything like that because you're going to be compared to the Taliban. And it seems like the Old Testament is reading a lot like what a modern-day jihadist would do. Well, nobody wants to be a modern-day jihadist, and so maybe what was going on here is this is all just allegorical. You know, this is just symbolic of spiritual struggle and so forth. I just want to say I don't think that that's the best way to read the Old Testament. Instead, what I think is going on is there was real battle going on. I just want to unpack some things, reasons as to why. But I also want to make an interesting observation here. It's interesting to me that you have atheists that are objecting morally to to what God is doing. And here's why I find this interesting, is I can't figure out how an atheist would ground morality at all. This is actually, I wrote a dissertation on this. When I was doing my PhD, this is what I ended up writing my dissertation on. And I devoted an entire chapter on the problems of naturalism and ethics. Where are you getting these values from? Where are you getting these commands from? It's difficult because on the one hand, what they want to say is there are some things that are absolutely morally wrong. By the way, I agree. There are some things that are absolutely morally wrong. But it's totally different to say that there are some things that are absolutely morally wrong, and I can, through my worldview, tell you why it's morally wrong. Atheism starts with this idea. Atheism starts with a valueless process. Even if you start with something like the Big Bang, there are no values there. There's just an event. That's it. And then from there, at some point, values just happen in the created order. And that's where I jump back and I go, well, where did they come from? And atheism has a hard time telling that story. So on the one hand, they want to condemn God based on a moral fabric or a moral foundation. But then on the other hand, they don't have a worldview that can account for the moral foundation they want to condemn God with. So maybe there's another way of looking at things. In Joshua, Joshua is said to have left no one remaining, destroying all that breathed as Yahweh commanded. This is in Joshua chapter 10, verse 40. You see it in Joshua chapter 11, verses 14 and 15. Now, historically, let me do a little bit of history for you. Historically, after battle, the victors either enslaved the defeated or they wiped them out. Now, I'm talking about back in the ancient Near East. Those were your two basic options. And here's why. One of the reasons that you would enslave them is that it kept them under your control. These are people that were enemy combatants against you. You need to remember it was a more primitive time, and it was a way of keeping them under control. Or if you just wipe them out, that's another way of ensuring that the problem isn't going to persist, because let's face it, the enemy is truly defeated, and once they're truly defeated, they can't come back and act against you. Ashurbanipal, and I know that you're all sitting there going, I should have named my kid that. I should have. Ashurbanipal described how he mutilated and hung captives, including boys and girls. So when you think about this is not an Israelite practice, this is an Assyrian practice. And he even bragged about it. Let me give you another example. King Misha of Moab had a monument indicating they wiped out two Israelite towns, including the women and the girls. Now, this isn't what the Israelites were doing to them. This is what they were doing before any of this narrative to the Israelites. That being said, some Old Testament scholars, like a David Lamb, will say some of the language that you see in Joshua chapter 10 and 11, wipe them all out, maybe it's hyperbole. Or as I like to say, a hyperbole, right? So hyperbole means it's an exaggeration. You know, kind of like when you say, all right, so, you know, A&M's going to be playing Texas State here a week from Thursday, and we're going to totally wipe them out. We are going to totally wipe them out, right? But nobody from Texas State is going to be dead. You know, it's not like the whole football team is going to be. It's supposed to be a hyperbole. It's an exaggeration to make a point, which is, you know, good Lord willing, the Aggies win by a large margin, obviously, and I'm wearing my A&M ring. All right, you got it. Hyperbole. So comparing Joshua 10 and 11 with other texts shows that the Israelites did not kill all the Canaanites or even drive them all out of the land. We already know that. There are even foreigners participating in ceremonies with them in Joshua chapter 8. So we need to take the whole narrative and kind of keep this thing in mind. The other thing is this. There's no mention, as you read Joshua, there's no explicit mention of women and children being killed. That's not actually there. There's also another difference. Unlike the Assyrians and the Moabites, Israel was trying to reclaim their own land, right? So with Assyria, the Assyrians or the Moabites, they were trying to take what wasn't there. Israel is trying to go back and take what already was theirs. Much of the land, by the way, had already been purchased by their ancestors. You find this in Genesis 23 and Genesis 33. It was theirs for the taking. So with that in mind, I know I'm kind of blitzing you because I want to get a lot in, but I also want to leave some time for questions. There's something that I want you to keep in mind because we always have to keep this clear. I want to take those commands to go and to attack the Canaanites pretty seriously. But I also want to pull apart this difference because the whole objection to what's going on in the narrative is that God is doing something wrong by commanding it. But if you look at the practices that I was enumerating for you before with the Canaanites, I think we need to make a distinction between something being evil, which is this is the way that the world ought not to be, and suffering. Now, I've made that distinction before, but I think we need to bring it up again. Because sometimes what you see is God judges a person or a group of people, and you usually see this after extensive acts of God to get them to repent and to turn to him. It's not like this. He doesn't just blow up and say, that's it, I'm wiping you out. Instead, you see God constantly trying to get them to turn and go another way, and they won't. In fact, they dig their heels in, and they go even further in the direction that they're already going. And after a while, what you see is God says, I've given you basically enough of a grace period, and now it's time for judgment. When it gets to the point of judgment, what we can agree is that the Canaanites endured tremendous suffering. I'm not going to take that away because I don't know how you could. They endured tremendous suffering. But suffering and evil are not the same thing. When God says it's time for judgment, suffering is what is the result of the judgment. But the judgment itself is not evil. I mean, imagine this. Because when you think about the Israelites, these are a displaced people. They're trying to travel from Egypt. They're scattered all the way up back to the promised land. They're trying to reclaim what is theirs after over 400 years of being enslaved. And then you have these people that are practicing these things. They're also there not, well, to protect their interests, but to harm them and would wipe them out if they could. You know that something's going to happen. It's in the fabric of what's happening between those two cultures. They're not going to peaceably coexist, and they didn't. So evil and suffering are not the same thing, and divine judgment produces suffering that is not evil. In fact, God's judgment is exactly the way that the world ought to be. It's unfortunate, it's regrettable, but that doesn't make it wrong. And so the destruction of inhabitants is viewed as an act of divine punishment. For what? For the things I've already mentioned. Idolatry, child sacrifice, bestiality, and so forth. I also want to point this out. There were unwarranted attacks on a defenseless Israel after they were freed from captivity. Now, these are people that, it's not like they're saying, all right, so now that we've got the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines together, we can head back to the promised land. It's like, you've been delivered from the Egyptian captivity. They're nomadic, which means they're traveling. They're not a standing militia when you think about it. They're just trying to get home. And all the while, what you see is they get attacked by the Amalekites. This is in Exodus chapter 17. They get attacked by the Amorites in Numbers chapter 21. They get attacked by Bashan in Numbers chapter 21. And Israel initiated none of those engagements. They're just trying to get home. So they're peace, well, they're trying to get back home and they're constantly being attacked. So there's always more to the story, isn't there? But I also want us to remember this, because we're only seeing one part of the one side of the ledger right now. And what it seems like is that there's this hard, harsh judgment against the Canaanites. And I'll agree, it's harsh. But it's not like you don't see God judging his own people in the Old Testament as well. Fair enough? Because God does. You know, God's not sitting there going, hey, I don't care what the Israelites do. They have a free check. They can do whatever they want. They can go against any of my commands. And there's not going to be any punishment because, you know what? They're my people. You don't see that anywhere in the Old Testament. Instead, God even punishes his own people with death and exile. Judah and Israel were destroyed and exiled from their land. If you look at 2 Kings 17, right? So God is, so to speak, an equal opportunity judger, if you want to look at the Old Testament that way. Here's another thing that we need to remember when we're reading these difficult passages, because they are difficult. I mean, if I were to sit here and say, how many of you have, beyond your devotional reading of Scripture, which is good, but you really start to intentionally and methodically read the Bible, you come on these passages, how many of you have said, I'm not sure what to do with that? It seems pretty tough. Does that seem fair? All of this is what's going on. And so we also need to remember this. Every person and nation that showed hospitality to Israel was delivered. Let me repeat that. Every person and nation that showed hospitality to Israel was delivered. Remember Rahab? Later, Rahab and her family were spared from the destruction of Jericho because she helped the two spies, Joshua 6. A peace treaty was initiated by the Gibeonites. And as a result of the peace treaty that they signed in Joshua 9, they were spared. That's a person, Rahab, and then you have a people group. with the Gibeonites. Saul spared the Kenites. They were, by the way, among the Amalekites. I know you're remembering all this, right? These were the people among the Amalekites because they were kind, and I'm just quoting here, they were kind to Israel during their wandering in 1 Samuel chapter 15. In every instance that you see a person or a nation that shows hospitality to Israel, guess what you see? You see God's deliverance. He spares his judgment. So let me give you a quick review about the Canaanites. They were being punished for wickedness. Israel was not crusading to expand their borders, but to reclaim what was rightly theirs. Yahweh, God, was slow to anger, waiting the entire period of Israel's enslavement, which is over 400 years, before he renders a judgment against the Canaanites. I just want to say this. If you're an Israelite, you're probably sitting there going, when are you going to do something? Right? It's been 100 years. Hey, when are you going to do something, God? It's been 200 years. Hey, when are you going to do something, God? It's been 300 years. When are you going to do something, God? It's been 400 years. And then God goes, right now, right now. God's patient. God is patient. And I look at these narratives and I see the judgment, but I also see the rest of the story, that it didn't have to be this way. A little bit more of a review. The conquest was pretty normal in the ancient Near East. The victors, they typically enslaved the losers. The destruction was widespread. I'm not convinced it was complete because you see Canaanites even mentioned in the New Testament. Some would say that that's a failure of the Israelites. They should have wiped them out and they didn't. Okay, that's the rest of the story, but I'm just saying the destruction wasn't absolute. The other thing is this, and here's what's really debated. As you look at Exodus 23, you look at Numbers 32, you look at Deuteronomy chapter 4, these narratives about war and violence. Let me tell you what Old Testament scholars really debate. And what they really debate is this. Does the text actually say to wipe out every living thing, man, woman, child? Or does the text say drive out everything, man, woman, and child? I just want to be fair. Old Testament scholars are going to disagree. But you can see on the face of it a huge difference. On the one hand, if we're supposed to understand the Hebrew there to mean wipe out everything, then obviously it's mass slaughter. And let me be fair, the Hebrew there is really tricky. It's very tricky. But it would be a mass slaughter. Everything's going to be dying. On the other hand, if it's drive them out, then usually that still happens by military means. But the goal isn't necessarily to end their life. It's to displace them from the land that they're possessing. So you can see kind of the debate. I just want you to see it. But notice this. Even in Exodus chapter 23, even there, God tells the Israelites that he will drive them out with hornets and angels. Go look at the text. Before there's even battle, God sends hornets, which are horrible, by the way. Anybody other than me been stung by them? Hornets and angels to drive some of the Canaanites out, which means however many Canaanites were inhabiting the land before battle ensued, that number was drastically reduced before war began. All right. I think that's a lot of information. How many of you agree with me? Feeling good about it, though? What I want to do, I'm going to invite Matthew to join me wherever Matthew is. I want to spend a little bit of time on your quest. I actually have more that I prepared, but I think I hit you pretty good. Imagine being my seminary students, you know, because at this point, they would ask this question. Is that all going to be on the test, right? And you know what I would say? Absolutely. Of course it is. Of course it is. But I do want to spend a little bit of time in getting to your questions. So, I don't know, where's Matthew? You ready to go? Come on up, man. Let me move this and let's go for it. See, this is the part, Matthew, that I think is unfair. Because in seminary, I do the teaching and right. Then the students have to answer questions.
Yeah, this is
tonight,
great.
I do the teaching and then I have to answer
the
questions.
That's the way it should work.
Not
I
cool.
I think we're good. I think we're good.
All right, let's go for it. Are y'all ready? Let's do it.
We have plenty of good questions. One thing I was thinking of as you were doing this is sometimes we put a lens on this from a, and I'd like for you to clarify this a little bit if you could, a kind of a Western 21st century lens on a perspective of what it looks like to live 3,000, 5,000, 6,000 years ago, depending on the context of this.
Yeah.
Can you kind of provide us with an idea of how these people lived in relation to that? As in, literature during that time was written in a very certain way that we don't write in a way now, and
yeah.
How we would look at that.
Yeah, you know, if you look at, you say, well, what, obviously, anytime you're reading a book, it can be a book today, or it can be a book from, it can be Plutarch. You know, I quoted Plutarch earlier. It could be Plutarch. And you say, well, what was their intention in writing? You might want to understand that, because it's going to shape the way that they write their book. It really isn't until the what's usually called the modern era. And by the way, that's around 1600. So, you know, don't be thinking last 30 years, right? You need to be thinking around the time of Descartes, René Descartes, and so forth. This is when you see writing take on a little bit of a different shape, where, like, chronology, we want everything. We want every nitpick and detail. We want everything to be laid out in a certain way. That's when you start to see history get chronicled a little bit differently.
Right.
In the ancient Near East, they didn't really care as much about that. So that would be, you know, that would be one difference. Because imagine this. Imagine the Bible actually having in it explicitly some of the stuff that I was unpacking that you find from historians that you don't actually get directly from the Bible.
Right.
Now, there's nothing wrong with getting that information from the historians. In fact, it's usually very helpful. Who are the Canaanites? Well, I'll tell you, right? Here's Plutarch. Here's others, right? That's good. But imagine all of that stuff actually being in the Bible,
mm-hmm.
right? So what you see is you see this narrative where the Canaanites are mentioned. You don't see the full array in terms of the detail mentioned in the Old Testament to the extent that I was mentioning it there. And this is what people find interesting. And you go, why didn't God just put it in there? Because then we don't have to do Veritas on a Sunday night.
Right.
Right? Because you would be sitting at home and you'd be reading your Old Testament and you would be reading all of that stuff already in there. And you go, ah, those were horrible people. Whereas when you read it and it mentions the Canaanites, we don't have that fully developed and refined view of them. And you kind of go, I don't know, that just seems a little harsh. And all of it is because the way that they chronicle history and what they were trying to get at was something different than a lot of times what we even care about.
Right. Well, I think sometimes we forget that they were people. They were God's creation, just like we are.
Absolutely. And I tried to point that out.
Yes, you did. There. But sometimes I think we look at the Canaanites like the same people who get destroyed in Lord of the Rings. You know, hey,
yeah, that's right.
It's okay.
Yeah.
You know, they're just they're the bad guys, but actually they were real people.
Yeah, they're real people with real problems that became entrenched in a whole culture.
Right.
And then it just became cyclical. The kinds of things that you see with, you know, with bestiality, incest, and those kinds of things, it just became ingrained in the culture itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that may, I've said this before, I struggle with what does it mean when it says that, you know, their sin had reached its full measure? And you see that language mentioned in the Old Testament. And I've said, I'm not exactly sure. But one of the things I've wondered is maybe what's happening is when practices get so entrenched in a culture that it's never, so to speak, going to break from the culture, that's when God says, that's it. You know, I'm just coming down in a thunderous judgment. I'm coming down.
Right.
Yeah.
You very briefly mentioned Noah.
Yeah.
And we know that Noah's descendants, or Ham, his son, the Canaanites came from.
From him.
From him.
Yeah, Genesis 9.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So any thoughts on how that ties into the Canaanites? Because eventually there's two different groups running through here.
Yeah. Chip McDaniel's an Old Testament scholar I really like. Mm-hmm. He and I were colleagues up at Southeastern. I taught there for 9 years. And, you know, when you look at Ham and you say, well, of course, the Canaanites are derivative of that line, right? You go, got it. You go, all right, so what was Ham up to? And what was the sin of Ham? Now, to be fair, it's somewhat debated.
It is debated.
It is debated.
It could get very
because it says that you know Ham walks in and sees Noah in his nakedness, and at that you go, well, what was that, right? Well, one, you've got a son that obviously isn't protecting the interests and the integrity of his father. That's nobody's really debating that part, But here's what some other Old Testament scholars will debate. They'll say, no, it's actually a little bit stronger than that. Now, I just want you to see the debate. All right, so this is, I wrestle with this too. But if you see the debate as it was more than just seeing his father's nakedness and not covering him up, mm-hmm. showing respect and honor to his father like his brothers did, instead it was something sexual in nature, then you look at all the practices of the Canaanites after that, then you might have a little bit more of an understanding of what Ham was up to. So if the line of the Canaanites goes back to, if it is Genesis 9, right, goes back to the story of Ham and Noah, if there was something sexual that was happening there, notice that's a practice of a son against his own father.
Right.
And it would fit very well with the rest of the narrative that I was putting together, I hope you were getting, with the Canaanites before, when incest had become so much of a practice for them. That story fits together pretty well.
It does, yeah. And then if you tie in Solomon and his 1,000 friends.
Friends.
700 concubines, 300 wives.
That was the nicest way I've ever heard that said about Solomon.
Yeah. You know, he goes that same path.
Well, he does.
Right. It's that same sort of.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And that's why I said, look, God, you know, God's judging everybody. He's right. Not just judging the Canaanites. Notice with Solomon in 1 Kings chapter 3, you know, he gets this warning, right? You know, be careful with women. Mm-hmm. And he's not saying that women are bad. I think he's knowing something about Solomon, right?
Right.
Be very careful. And by 1 Kings chapter 11, it says, and many women turned the heart of Solomon.
Right.
That's only 8 chapters away. That's not that much time, people. I'm just kidding. I don't know how much time that was. But, you know, so you've got 1,000 different women. And most of them, by the way, were purely political. That's all it was.
Oh, yeah.
It was purely political. Absolutely.
Yeah, for the furthering of their own gods.
Furthering of their own gods, and Solomon was fine, even built temples, mm-hmm. and even worshiped with them in those temples.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. A few other questions here.
A few?
You okay?
I'm good.
You ready? Okay. All right. Are we not all under the wrath of God without faith in his son? And if so, his judgment on any pagan people by any means, elements, natural disasters, death, is divine justice?
Yeah, so I think it's a good question. You know, when you think of a natural disaster, I will say this: there's an epistemological problem. So here's what I mean by that when I say that. You know, epistemology is the study of the theory of knowledge. When can I say I know something? We might have a hard time discerning that God is judging us through a natural disaster. We might have a hard time discerning that. To be fair, mm-hmm. right? I mean, if you're Job, and you know the great wind blows, the walls collapse, and his children die, probably it looked like a great wind blew, even though we know something supernatural was happening there. So let's just go ahead and say that. But are there times where God uses natural disasters to judge? And the answer is, in the Exodus itself, right? Mm-hmm. And you go back to the time of the Pharaoh, and God uses natural means to bring judgment on hard-hearted people. So am I open to that possibility? Biblically, I think I have to be, because God has done it before. But I would still want to keep this distinction, because it's important. When it gets to the point of divine judgment, that's what it is. It's divine judgment. And also, let's be clear here. God has certain prerogatives that we don't. Let's be clear here, right? I mean, God's not going to make a mistake in his judgment. The other thing is God isn't subject to, like, you know, fits of rage and anger where his emotions are out of control. That's why I said we always have to keep the narrative in our mind where God is reaching out to the Canaanites, or he's reaching out to the whoever-ites, and he's sending a messenger beforehand to say, hey, repent. You know, stop it. Go a different way. The judgment that is coming doesn't have to be here. You see that thread all the way throughout the Bible. And so, does God judge? The answer is yes. Does God use multiple means of judgment? The answer is yes. Is God merciful and patient? And the answer is yes, absolutely.
Right.
And so it's all of the above.
It is. And you see that again. We talked about this briefly last week about the prophets.
Yeah.
Time and time again, they're brought to the people to be told. But
absolutely.
On a modern day context, where is that today? If you look at it from our viewpoint of 21st century, what is it? We don't. I mean, there could be prophets, but how do we know at this point.
Yeah. Okay. So one of the key distinctions that I would want to make, you say, is there a difference between now and like the ancient Near East? And I think one of the differences is we don't live in a theocracy, right? And so, you know, the idea of a theocracy is that you had God literally was the one over Israel, right? And even when there was a king was under God as God was over Israel. And so there was a theocracy. We're not a theocracy here. So I would certainly want to make that distinction, right? Because if you look at how about skip the U.S.? Let's just look at Texas, right? People will look at Texas and say, Texas is like the buckle of the Bible Belt. And I'm like, are we really? We have, around 22 million people and growing. I think one out of every 10 kids that's being born in the United States right now is being born in Texas. That's a mind-boggler. But as it stands, of around the 22 million people in Texas, about 45% have nothing to do with God whatsoever. Nothing whatsoever. That's Texas. So they're going, that's not much of a buckle, right? I mean, right. If it is, your pants are drooping.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, come on. And what's true of Texas seems to be true of a lot of the United States, right? Mm-hmm. So does there come a point where God says, okay, I'm going to judge a nation? I can't rule that possibility out. But you see God using what in the Old Testament? Name some of the people that God uses to judge Israel, right? Mm-hmm. You can think of some examples. It's not just natural disasters. Who else does he use?
Right.
He used enemy nations to judge Israel, people that we would look at and go, hey, those are evil people.
Yeah, the Babylonians.
The Babylonians. Persians, those are not good people, absolutely. Right? And they're going to be my agent of judgment against you because you will not believe in me. You won't repent. Right? God does this all. So the way I look at it is since God has certain prerogatives that we don't, God can use whatever means is necessary to bring us back to him. Which, by the way, that's exactly what his judgment is for.
Right.
It's always for that. It's always for that. It might be harsh, but the intention is usually reconciliation and redemption.
Right.
Right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. By the way, good question, whoever asked that one. And that's it. You don't get to ask another question either, right? So, I'm just kidding. You do.
So this will be kind of a follow-up question to that. It's one of those things where I think if we look at it from a Texas perspective, or even a Houston or Kingwood perspective, or we could expand it to the world, knowing that everyone in the world is created by God and equal in God's image. But as a culture, are we approaching that same level of depravity, sexual depravity, that the Canaanites were? And I guess it'd be even hard to even judge that.
Yeah, that's tough to judge. Yeah. I'm going to leave that part up to God. So let me do that. But let me give one example that we're dealing with that I think is. You know, the impact that it is having is understated, and it's the porn problem. The impact that it's having is understated. And by the way, it is a sexual problem. Let's don't kid ourselves. When you have, Covenant Eyes does a lot of work on this, but when you, and there's also a book I'd recommend called Hooked, and it doesn't just deal with pornography, it deals with sexuality in general. And what happens, you know, as people start to engage in sex, and literally it starts to rewire the brain. So this is the stuff that we know. How prolific is the pornography problem? If you just look at the U.S. and you go, well, the studies have been done. I mean, the porn industry is clearing more in terms of profit than every major news organization combined. It's clearing more profit than every major sports organization combined, NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, right? These things are not really questions. And you go, all right, so it seems to be profitable, so there's certainly that. But then you go, all right, so what impact is it having? Well, it's ruining marriages, right, among other things. Now, I only bring that up basically to make a point, because the question, if what you had with the Canaanites was there was a lot going on that was sexual in nature, we're right to ask, what's the line that God draws before he looks at the U.S. and says, and now I'm coming down on you. I'll admit, I don't know what that line is. I don't know that I would have known the line back then either. You know,
no,
if I'm just walking around and the Canaanites are walking around me, a lot of times we get used to this stuff,
right.
And that's the problem. That's the problem. We're not making good judgments on these things. God is. So I'm going to leave that part up to God. is the U.S. subject to judgment any more than any other country, ancient or current? And the answer is, you bet. And I have no problem saying it. I have no problem saying it. That's why I don't worship this country. I'm just not going to do it. I love it. I respect it. I have a lot of family that have fought for it. Good. I'm not going to worship it. Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen. I'm going to worship Jesus, right? I'm going to worship Jesus. That's it. And my loyalties to my country are limited to his standards. And when I see my country start to go a different direction, I'm going to pray for the country to turn. But can I also tell you this? I pray for other countries too. Far as I can tell, Jesus died for every tribe, tongue, and nation. So I pray for every tribe, tongue, and nation. That includes my own people. So
makes absolute sense.
It makes absolute sense. Yep. Are we subject to it? You bet.
Oh, I don't even know if I want to ask this one.
That can't be good. I've been up here talking about incest and bestiality, and Matthew goes, ooh, I can't ask that.
Well,
this can't be good.
I just don't know. I don't know when you're going to cover this. So
okay.
Let's see here.
And by the way, if it's a question that I'm going to cover in the coming weeks, mm-hmm. I'll just say that. Is that okay? I'll like give you kind of a, hey, that's coming up. All right.
Let's talk about child sacrifices.
Child sacrifice?
Child sacrifice.
Okay.
So we see that a lot through the Canaanite worshiping practices and everything. We see it eventually reaching over into Israel and a lot of the godless kings. Jesus will reference it, we would believe, when he refers to Gehenna and the area in which sacrifices were made.
Right.
Can you put that together about how we even get to that point related to child sacrifices within the, from Canaanites, the people of Israel, to now how Jesus would look back onto that?
If I understand the question correctly, there are child sacrifices that are mentioned even in the Old Testament, right? That are not a part of Canaanite practices.
Right.
Nevertheless, what you see is that those narratives are descriptive, not prescriptive.
Right.
Right? So it's describing something that is happening. It's not prescribing something to happen. And by the way, this study is coming up in Genesis 22, the binding of Isaac. So take your son up on Mount Moriah and sacrifice your son. Right, which doesn't happen. So I think we're supposed, it doesn't happen. You know that. So it doesn't happen. But I think we're supposed to take something from Genesis 22 and work forward, right? Yeah. God says, I will provide a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Now in the Genesis 22, that's the ram in the thicket, right? It's not your son. And what Old Testament scholars will look at that and they'll say, right. And so there's something not just for God's people, but for everyone around that you see a stark difference between Yahweh and all of the other gods. And it's that Yahweh is not looking for that, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
So I would start with Genesis 22 and kind of work my way out mm-hmm. and understand any of those narratives according to Genesis 22. Does that help a little bit?
It does, yeah. I think what's being asked here.
But we still have the problem of why command it then,
right?
But I'm going to save that because I want you to come back.
Well, I think the descriptive versus prescriptive is a huge.
It's a huge difference.
We face that constantly because if you read, say, if you're reading the Psalms and the prayers of David, and what he's saying,
sure,
he's wanting to win the battles. If you really look through those,
yeah,
and, you know, there's God intervention as part of that as well. But it's almost like you're looking inside of a human's mind, his psyche and soul, as he's praying to God, kind of like how we do. But it's not like God saying, destroy those people right now. It's nope. David wanting to do it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what Matthew's bringing up is what's usually called the problem of the imprecatory psalms.
That's
right?
What I was going to say, but...
Yeah. The imprecatory psalms. So where you have, you have David saying, smite my enemies and break their jaws and face. Right? Which, by the way, I prayed last night. I'm kidding. I didn't.
Against Texas State or?
No, stop it. That's going to come when A&M's playing Clemson because it's time for them to lose, y'all. It's time for them to lose. The imprecatory Psalms are interesting. I have a friend that's a professor at the University of Loyola, and he says, it is time for somebody to rip those out of the pages of the Bible. Now, I was like, no, it's time for you to understand what's going on in the pages of the Bible. I don't think you need to rip them out. And I think you were spot on. You can't look at, when you look at the imprecatory Psalms, and it's like, I want God to crush my enemies. And the language is really intense, right? I think what you're getting at is you're getting very honest gut level communication between David or somebody else and God. I want this to stop.
Right.
You take care of this. By the way, he's taking it to God who can take care of it, to be fair, right?
But is God going to do it in the way he
But
wants
is God going to do it the way not he wants or the, yeah, the way that David is asking him to do it or another way? And that's, yeah, so.
That's a whole other
That's
other
a whole other thing. We can do imprecatory psalms. There's some juicy ones out there.
There are.
Man, yeah. You know, crush their nose is only one example.
Right? Oh, no. Yeah,
break their jaw.
It's very violent.
It is.
You make a TV show out of it, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Sign of a healthy prayer life is that you're praying stuff like that, everybody, you know?
Jeez.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
No,
stop.
I know. Yeah. So again, I want to stay on the descriptive, prescriptive side of it. Can you kind of break down the difference of this question based on why would it be okay to ever kill a child, most specifically a Canaanite child?
Yeah. Okay. Number one, let me point this out. It's debated on whether or not children were killed.
Right.
That's debated. So, you know, Chip McDaniel, who I mentioned before, he says when it came to the Canaanites, they had several options here when they knew that the people of God were coming up against them. One is that they could turn to Israel. They could turn to Yahweh, right? There's one possibility, is that they could get over their idolatry. They could get over their false worship, and they could worship God. That's one possibility. They didn't choose that, but they could have chosen that. There's one. Here's a second thing. They could run. Get out. I mean, you know the combatants are coming. Get out. Or the third is you can make this decision. We're going to stay. We're going to trust our government, and we're going to trust our army. Now, apparently, some made that choice. Right. Also, but remember, I also gave the other example where God, before they even come in, he sends in hornets and angels to drive some of the people out. Right? So for whatever is happening there, some of those numbers are, that's why I said some would say this is hyperbolic, right? It's, we totally crushed them, right? Okay. But nevertheless, there's that. In the event that there is a child that dies, I think there are a couple of things that we would want to factor in. One is usually in a time of war, those are things that happen. It's not the, and this is where you have to get to the intent, right? So even now, if we were engaged in a time of war and there was a bomb that is dropped or something like that and debris scatters out and you see that a child is killed, it was never the intention for the child to be killed. It was the intention of the combatant to be killed. And on that level, a lot of times the people that do work in just war theory would want to make that distinction, the intention actually does matter. So there is that. That being said, Clay Jones, who I quoted several times tonight, he doesn't take the hyperbolic view. He thinks it wiped them out. And it's every man, woman, and child. And the reason that he does, and this is something for you to chew on, is because he says this evil had become so entrenched from the top to the bottom that even the Canaanite children were a part of these practices. And so as he would argue, and I hope I'm getting him right here, as he would go on to argue, and so it's actually an act of mercy that God would take the life of a child rather than to leave them in that. Now, but this is also married to another belief that I believe that Clay Jones has, which is this. Those children have probably never reached what is probably better referred to as a state of accountability, right? That age where they not only understand what sin is, but even in understanding their sin, they're still choosing it. That's a state of accountability,
right?
And instead, usually what you see, whether it's a Clay Jones or a Paul Copan or a Matthew Flanagan or some others that have written on this problem, you know, God is going to bring those children into his presence because they haven't reached the same state as the adults had. I just want you to see that those are the, for the different views, you have the hyperbolic view, but you also have that, nope, it's the wipe them out view. Usually you're going to see that brought up.
But have you seen with that, in the original Hebrew, the word that they use, kind of at all,
yeah,
I mean, lack of a better term,
right,
was taken later on and spread to be women, children, men, women, children.
Oh, sure. Yeah, people will make
all the animals, everything.
Yeah, all of the animals. And I spoke to the animals when I was talking about bestiality. Yeah. You know, in the ancient Near East, these animals, once they were basically subject to what would more or less be like an orgy with animals, even to them, those animals were considered useless and were just cast out.
Right.
So why slaughter the animals? It's because even the animals became an outcast. They had no provisions. And so that's why I even brought that up. But even still, you have to deal with the problem of this. Canaanites are still mentioned in the New Testament. Mm-hmm. You also have to take seriously this. The point wasn't that God just judge Canaanites. It's that Canaanites come to God. That was the point. And that's why I said for every individual and for every group that showed mercy and, if you want to call it, friendship to the Israelites, God spared them in judgment. Did you notice me bringing that up? And you go, why is that? It's because that's what God was desiring to begin with. Right. That's why I said Chip McDaniel gave three examples. How could the Canaanites respond? Okay, they can turn to God, they can run, or they can stand under judgment. And by the way, when you fight against God, you're going to lose. I'm just going to go there, right? You fight against God, you're going to get whooped. It's going to happen. Take it to the bank. You might score some points, but the battle is God's. Three possibilities. Which one are you going to pick? Mm-hmm. Some of them chose the first. Well, why would God judge them? Why would he judge them? So that shows my inclination. My inclination is a little bit more toward the hyperbolic view.
Yeah.
Because of some considerations like that. So what I would probably do is say, all right, fine. So I'm going to make this adjustment here. He wipes out all of them that did not respond in the first sense, that turned to him, wiped.
So the lady that Jesus heals in the New Testament, Canaanite woman.
The Canaanite woman is healed.
Is an example of.
She obviously had to come from someone that was spared.
Right.
Or she wouldn't have been there.
Right.
Exactly. Right? And you go, well, what are the conditions under which they were spared? We already know what those were. Mm-hmm. Those were people that showed favorable relations to the people of God and to God.
Right.
That's why she's still there.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We're over 7 o'clock. It's after 7
Are
o'clock.
We? What time is it?
7:03.
All right. Let's do one more. Sound good? Because we still want to leave some on
that. I don't think you want to do this one.
Man, people, what's up with y'all tonight? I mean, asking the hard ones.
More higher voted one at this point.
Do we want to hold off?
Say that?
All right, let's hear the question. If it's something I'm addressing, I'll say, great way to end it.
Everyone in here but you knows what this question is if they have their phone on.
Yeah, okay. I'm not looking right. at it, right? I'm going cold up here, people. All right, go.
It's from a live stream viewer.
Okay.
You ready? Okay. Why does God care about people having sex?
Why does God care about people having sex?
How people have sex, sorry.
Okay, I think first we dealt with that with Theology on Tap on Tuesday night. And by the way, Matthew flying the Theology on Tap shirt. I commend you for that.
Oh, thank you.
All right, so why does God...
The only time I won't have a collar on.
Huh?
It's the only time I won't have a collar.
That's right, he's not wearing a collared shirt. It threw me, by the way. Okay, so I want you to think about, you know, I want you to think about what we talk about when we talk about, you know, a sexual relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, when you go back into Genesis chapter 2, you see God bringing a man and a woman together and establishing a covenant relationship there. Everything in Genesis chapter 2 is what sets the paradigm for every other relationship going forward, every other one. So when you see polygamy in the Old Testament, that violates the standard and the parameters that was established in Genesis chapter 2 going forward, right? It may be there, it may be descriptive, it's certainly not prescriptive. Yeah, go have a bunch of wives. It's not there. But you also see God establishing what and where sex was supposed to happen. And it's in a relationship between a man, one man, and one woman. That's where it happens. And in a covenant with one another. And there are a number of reasons why. You know, the covenant in a marriage is supposed to establish some boundaries that are beneficial for both the man and a woman. That is sexual, but it's more than sexual. It's that your wife or your husband is supposed to be a place of security. When you think of the vows, it's, I will keep you before myself for as long as we both live, regardless of the circumstances, right? And one of the things that we vow is that there's going to be a sexual purity that exists between a husband and a wife. And here's why. Is because when we deviate from those boundaries, then you're also deviating from the boundaries by which you're going to be blessed by the act itself. Sex is meant to be a blessing. It is the most intimate thing that you can find anywhere in Scripture, right? This is why when you look throughout the Bible, a lot of the language that is used in terms of God's relationship with his people is sexual, even though it's not literal. It's supposed to be an image, right? There's nothing that's more intimate that God has done in the way that he created a man and a woman. And even if you look in Genesis 2, this is before the fall. He looks at the man and he says, it isn't good that he's alone. And so you go, his aloneness isn't why, his brokenness isn't the problem. It's that we were built for these relationships. And the ultimate consummation of that relationship between the man and the woman is the sex act itself. Mm-hmm. So there's that. So why have some parameters set for it? And the answer is because once you say that there are no parameters for it and it's everything goes, then it becomes, so to speak, it becomes a baseless act that is removed from what the act is meant to be. Sex is more than physical. Biblically, sex is more than physical. And this is why it says when the two leave their father and mother and they become one flesh, that one flesh union is a literal union of two persons in the covenant with in a covenant that they made with God. Mm-hmm. So the parameters for its blessing occur there. Does that make any sense? Am I answering this well enough?
Yeah, sure.
So why does God care? That's why God cares. Richard Dawkins, by the way, and I quoted him earlier as saying, you know, why does God give a rip about people's sex lives so much, right? And God seems to be pretty small. Maybe God knows the conditions under which sex is a blessing and sex is a curse. Maybe God knows that. But the other thing I'd also want to say to Richard Dawkins is this. Richard Dawkins is an evolutionary biologist. Mm-hmm. And pretty much everything that you read in all the literature in evolutionary biology is about one of two things, survival or reproduction. Some of them are going, dude, you have spent your whole career looking at sex. So why are you so worried about what happens in people's bedrooms? Even he's talking about it. It's part and parcel of the study of evolutionary biology, albeit on a completely different plane.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. So that's why sex matters. It's important. And that's why I recommended, and this is where I'll stop. That's why I recommended the book Hooked. Go read it. It's short. It's very readable. Two medical doctors wrote it. And there's a lot more caught up in the sex act than you would think. Because we release chemicals that bond us to the person that we're having sex with. And even in the men, and even in men, we're kind of portrayed as the ones that would go and have sex with anything that we could have sex with. And in fact, that's not true. Even we release a chemical that bonds us to the one with whom we are having intercourse. It's very interesting. So, all right, there's a short answer. There's a lot more, but I'm stopping. You know why? Because we're over time.
We are. We want to respect our time.
We do.
Yeah.
All right, so there we go. Was tonight at least helpful a little bit for you? I know we covered a lot of terrain. Thank you so much for being here. We have a lot more going on next week. I invite you to come back. God bless. Have a great evening.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about Veritas, visit us at www.veritaswbc.com.